Well, sir, thank you very much.
I really appreciate it. I've seen a lot of your testimonies before they were actually taken down. I've seen some of the videos that were yours that were taken down off of YouTube. And then I found that very odd that a doctor talking about a medical disease would have videos taken down. An actual expert would be either testifying or discussing treatments and talking about a disease and have those videos taken down off of YouTube. Well, first of all, if you would please just state your credentials and tell everybody what you do.
I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. I'm an internist and cardiologist. I'm also trained in epidemiology. I'm in academic practice in Dallas, Texas, so I see patients about half the time. I saw patients yesterday, drove down today to see you here in the studio. And the rest of my time I spend as an author, an editor. I'm an editor of a major journal in cardiovascular medicine, the former editor of an international journal. I'm the president of a major medical society right now, currently, about 5 years into that position. And, you know, I frequently publish. I'm in my field. I study the interface between heart and kidney disease. I'm the most published person in my field in history. I have over 650 publications in the National Library of Medicine. I imagine that's probably ahead of anybody you've had on the show. They mentioned Paul Merrick. I'm just ahead of Paul Merrick. Pierre Corey mentioned him in critical care. I'm just ahead of Paul, a lot younger than he is. And in COVID, when COVID hit, I really dropped everything to put all of my academic efforts on this because I saw it as an all-hands-on-deck situation.
Now, when did things start to seem strange to you in terms of the way the information was allowed to be distributed, in terms of the way people were treating patients, and not just that, but the information on how to treat patients was distributed?
I didn't see this coming, to tell you the truth. I was pretty happy in life. Medicine was moving along for me and had a very highly ranked position at a major academic medical center and you know, traveled frequently and did all the things we normally do in academic medicine, you know, meeting, interchanging, challenging, being skeptical with one another. That is the lifeblood of academic medicine. And things were going great in March. This hit, we immediately took efforts we thought it was going to hit Dallas. We started looking at things, how to configure our workforces. I went and got a grant, got a large grant to study a prevention approach to protect our workers at our healthcare facility. And I worked with the FDA over a weekend to get an investigational new drug application awarded in my name in order to test a prophylactic approach. And things were going great in March. And I can tell you, it wasn't but a few weeks in April on these task force calls. I was on routine health system calls once a week, and I was on one with the National Institutes of Health. And I asked a question. I said, when are we going to start to treat the problem? I go, people are getting sick out there. They're starting to be hospitalized. Some are dying. When are we going to start to treat patients? It's too late for the hospitals. Too late to treat people. It's obvious they're dying in the hospital. We must start early. And you could basically hear a pin drop on these calls. No one had an idea about treating COVID-19 at home.
Was there no thought about it? Was there no discussion? Or was it just not a point of focus? Like, what was the problem there?
I think it was a grip of fear. Doctors, for the first time in their lives, felt like they could get the disease themselves if they actually saw and examined these patients. All the discussion was on personal protective equipment, hand sanitizer, negative airflow rooms. It was all about protecting the healthcare workers. There wasn't any focus on sick patients. And after the weeks went by, I became incredibly frustrated. I started communicating with our Italian colleagues. I said, what's going on? You guys are getting blasted in Milan. Is there anything we can do to treat patients at home and stop these hospitalizations?
And were you alone with this concern? Were there other doctors that were joining you with this? And were there treatment protocols that had been put into place that were being tested?
There were no treatment protocols that emerged. We started looking at work done by Didier Rialt in Marseille, France, by Vladimir Zelenko in Monroe, New York, and started communicating very early on with the Italians. And I had great relationships with the Italians in Milan. And what we had decided is we had decided on some principles early on. The first collaboration, and my contribution was really to get people together, get the ideas together and publish. And I had the publication strength that other people didn't, and got the first organized ideas together in April, May, June. We submitted our paper July 1st to the American Journal of Medicine, which is one of the highly ranked journals in medicine. And it was published in August. And this is the first publication teaching doctors how to treat COVID-19 with a multi-drug regimen. And the ground rules were this. We knew it was insufficient time for large randomized trials. Those take 2 to 4 years. I lead large randomized trials. I've published in the New England Journal of Medicine. I know what this is about. I'm on steering committees. We don't have 2 to 4 years. This is a mass casualty situation. We use the precautionary principle, meaning that this is a mass casualty event. We can't wait. We're looking for drugs with a signal of benefit and acceptable safety. We knew very early on that this viral infection had three components. It was viral replication, cytokine storm or inflammation, and then thrombosis. So we knew a single drug wasn't going to handle the problem. No way. It was going to be a multi-drug regimen, just like with HIV, just like with hepatitis C. No difference. It's going to be multi-drugs. So precautionary principle. We used signals of benefit, acceptable safety, drugs in a combination, test, retest, and go. And so at the time we submitted our paper, Joe, there was about 4,000 papers in the peer-reviewed literature on COVID-19. There was 55,000 papers in the peer-reviewed literature on COVID-19 and about 4,000 that could have related to certain drugs, but not a single one put the concepts together on how to treat patients.
So this was the first one, and it was published in August.
August of 2020, American Journal of Medicine, the title of the paper was The Pathophysiologic Rationale for the Early Ambulatory Treatment of COVID-19. That quickly after August spawned the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons Home Treatment Guide. So AAPS, interesting organization, it's independent doctors. They accept no money from pharmaceutical agencies. They've been around since 1943. They had early on sued the federal government to release the stockpile of hydroxychloroquine. U.S. had the right idea as other countries. They stockpiled hydroxychloroquine. Then there was the problem of it wasn't being released from the stockpile. And so during my development work early in 2020, I got a call from the White House. Peter Navarro called me. Said, listen, McCullough, can you help me get hydroxychloroquine released? Rick Bright and others in the FDA seem to be colluding to block hydroxychloroquine coming out of the stockpile. In Marseille, France, Didier Rial was working with hydroxychloroquine, and it was over-the-counter in France. They made a prescription, and they started making it hard for him to use. And then simultaneously in Australia, they had taken hydroxychloroquine, and they had put it up in Queensland as basically an untouchable drug. If a doctor attempted to use hydroxychloroquine to treat a COVID patient in early April, that doctor could be put in jail. So these things started happening early to try to prevent treatment of patients with COVID-19.
Why do you think that's the case? And why do you think that hydroxychloroquine would have been effective?
Well, 2006 forward, there were studies with hydroxychloroquine that demonstrated that it reduced replication of SARS-CoV-1, the first version of the SARS virus.
Yeah, we talked about that the other day. Wasn't it just chloroquine? Was it chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine?
Well, originally, there was chloroquine, hydroxychloroquine, and mefloquine. So there's anti-malarials. They're similar in terms of their biochemical property, but they have three mechanisms of action. They increase the lysosomal pH, so when the particle is taken into the cell, it doesn't travel so well to the nucleus. They chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine bring in zinc. It's a zinc ionophore. Zinc goes in and actually antagonizes the RNA-dependent polymerase, which is needed for the virus to replicate. And then hydroxychloroquine is a well-known and established anti-inflammatory. We use it in lupus. We use it in rheumatoid arthritis. And it's obviously an intracellular anti-infective. We use it for the prevention of malaria.
Was the problem that there was a lot of problems with Donald Trump being in office, that when he would approve of something or when he would talk about something, people would attack that thing. And hydroxychloroquine became something that he talked of as a cure and talked about as a treatment for COVID. And then it became politicized. And then support for hydroxychloroquine became support for Trump. Would you think that that was accurate?
I'd have to look at the timeline. Boy, it was quick, because the backlash against hydroxychloroquine was so strong in Brazil and Australia.
Why do you think that is, though?
No, but the timing, the question is, did it happen before or after Trump said anything? It happened very quickly. Through the course of the year, it was extraordinary. The second largest producer of hydroxychloroquine, the plant was mysteriously burned down outside of Taipei. It was extraordinary what was going on. Doctors from Africa were telling us that there were some type of mercenary people raiding the pharmacies at night and burning the hydroxychloroquine.
Now, this is before the emergency use exemption or the emergency use authorization for the vaccines. The emergency use authorization, in order to have that, you cannot have effective treatments.
We have to be careful. The emergency use authorization is a new mechanism or a previously unused mechanism for regulatory pathways of drugs. And my interpretation of it, and everybody's interpretation is fair game, so it's pretty loosely written, quite honestly, depends on indication. So a vaccine would be indicated for the prevention of COVID-19 illness. Hydroxychloroquine or bamlanivimab or any of these other drugs would be approved for the treatment of COVID. So two separate indications.
Okay.
So the EUA should not be viewed, in my view, as competitive. In fact, it can't, because remember, bamlanivimab, the Lilly product, as well as remdesivir, the Gilead product, they preceded the vaccines, and they didn't preempt the vaccines coming on the market.
But remdesivir had problems of its own, correct? With kidney failure and...
Well, remdesivir was basically a repurposed failed Ebola drug. And it does have intellectual property ties through Gilead back to the Chinese. So the Chinese originally were collaborating with us very tightly. I have tons of emails from the Chinese. They were trying to alert us what's going on with COVID-19. Remdesivir came up. It's a polymerase inhibitor. As a general, I told you hydroxychloroquine has three mechanisms of action. You've reviewed previously ivermectin, which also has three separate mechanisms of action. Remdesivir is a one-horse show. It's a single mechanism of action. It inhibits the polymerase, and it unfortunately, as the data have borne out, it's given far too late in the illness, right? So the polymerase is active early in viral replication. So if you gave it on day one, it may actually do something. But if you give it on day 14, by the time someone comes in the hospital, the virus is done replicating at that point in time. And then all it can do is offer toxicity. And you're right, it's a five-day infusion of remdesivir. Early on, we heard about the hepatic toxicity. In my experience, I could never get a patient through 5 days of therapy because the liver function test, the AST and ALT, would skyrocket. Now it's become clear it's been associated with acute kidney injury. And the kidney injury is not tolerated in COVID-19 because any retention of fluid makes the oxygen saturation in the lungs far worse.
So why do you think there was this demonization of hydroxychloroquine? And why, I mean, do you have a theory as to why they would try to restrict the distribution of it, or why they would, if someone wanted to burn down the factories that produce it, why they would do that?
It was clear that hydroxychloroquine was the most promising drug that we had for COVID-19. By the way, we tested ritonavir, lopinavir, HIV drugs. They quickly fell to the side. Other drugs were tested, but hydroxy came forward as the lead agent, and currently we're up to 300 completed studies with hydroxychloroquine, 32 early treatment studies, and it does have an effect size or an efficacy early in treatment of about 64% globally across the studies, and its toxicity profile is well understood. Hydroxychloroquine, like ivermectin and the other drugs, are already FDA approved. The FDA tells doctors to use drugs off-label. It's in their guidance to us. And actually, FDA has a piece to patients that was published in 2018 saying, why does your doctor use off-label drugs? And it says, when the doctors are fulfilling an unmet need, i.e. COVID-19. There's no new drugs for COVID-19. So we use these drugs, what's called clinically indicated, medically necessary, appropriate off-label use of drugs. Hydroxy was the first one up. A giant mistake was to actually place an emergency use authorization on hydroxychloroquine. And the original EUA that was placed on hydroxy, which it didn't need one because it's already on the market, right? It was placed for inpatient use. And then the interpretation was that it was the hydroxychloroquine was restricted at inpatient use. So once it became restricted at inpatient use, then there was messages saying, listen, don't use it unless somebody's an inpatient. Then when we found out that hydroxychloroquine, like ivermectin, works best early and has less of an effect late, like all the other drugs, because people are too far gone. Once those trials were completed, there's 5 randomized trials of inpatients with hydroxychloroquine as they're about to go on the ventilator. And those 5 trials are neutral. They don't show harm. They don't show benefit. They're neutral. One of them was the NIH trial. There's only 2 placebo-controlled trials, by the way. So we've based the entire house on hydroxychloroquine on two placebo-controlled small inpatient trials that were didn't have sufficient power to see an effect if indeed it was there. Having said that, they were flat on the outcomes of mortality and progression in the hospital. And so based on that, in June of 2020, the FDA came out across the board and said, based on this, do not use hydroxychloroquine to treat COVID-19, period. Period. Full stop. They never reviewed the data a second time or a third time. And I can tell you as a doctor, the FDA, the CDC, and the NIH are public service agencies to me and you. We don't work for them. They don't issue us rulings. They work for us. And I'm telling you, as a leader in academic medicine, my expectation was monthly reviews from those three entities and the White House Task Force. Matter of fact, the White House Task Force can do it. I needed a monthly report of what drugs were working and what drugs weren't. We didn't see any of that.
Why do you think that is?
I talked to Scott Atlas. I presented with him a couple weeks ago, and I had dinner with Scott. He was on the inside. He worked side by side with these people for months. And I said, Scott, what is going on? Scott goes, I did what Peter McCullough would do. I showed up every day with the data. I analyzed things. I had the updates on what's going on with the pandemic. Now, Scott was focused on mass contagion control in schools, but he's an academic. He's at Stanford Hoover Institute. I said, yeah. I said, what about the other people on the task force? What about the head of the NIAID? What about the CDC director? He goes, they showed up with nothing. I said, you got to be kidding me. They're not analyzing any data? He goes, have you ever seen them come on TV and analyze any studies? I said, no. He thinks that this is a crisis of academic incompetence, believe it or not.
Just incompetence, not some sort of a conspiracy to demonize hydroxychloroquine for profit, for some other means to promote some other treatment or drug.
It wasn't me, but someone in the crowd. This was a symposium that was held by Pam Popper, by the way. Dr. Popper's got a wonderful book out on COVID-19, and so does Scott Atlas. His is about the White House. And someone in the audience asked Scott, he said, listen, do they have another intention? Were they directly trying to squash hydroxychloroquine at the time? He said no. He said they had good intentions for the nation. He says they're just incompetent.
So is it possible that the demonization of hydroxychloroquine was because Donald Trump supported it? Because I know for like the way I had been hearing about it was hearing about it through him. That he talked about it. It's basically a miracle. Remember all that stuff? He was saying it was a miracle.
As I recall, that was late March. I think when it was honestly made illegal in Australia, it was early April. I went on Tucker Carlson. We had the same type of discussion. Tucker says, how did the Australians know to make it illegal so early in April? He goes, that's before all the research was done. Remember, Henry Ford came out with a 3,000-patient study and actually used in the hospital. It wasn't randomized, but they got consent. It was very carefully done. I was a program director at Henry Ford in the past. I know that institution really well. High quality, top shelf. I was communicating with them. They said, listen, it works. It is clear it works. This is an unconfounded study. And that was one of the studies that, in fact, we relied upon in order to put hydroxychloroquine in sequence multidrug therapy. That was before the data with ivermectin came in. So ivermectin came in later. So our update, when we published our update in December of 2020, we brought in ivermectin. The Japanese had told us about favipiravir and the Russians had. A lot of people don't know this. There is an oral antiviral approved and used in Japan and Russia and four states in India called favipiravir. That is an oral polymerase inhibitor, so it's like an oral remdesivir. It's very similar to the new drug, molnupiravir. This is an oral polymerase inhibitor. So the antivirals, we actually, by our recommendations, now had three antivirals that we could recommend worldwide for that layer of treatment. Now, antivirals alone are not sufficient and they are not necessary to treat COVID-19. It's very interesting for people to say this. People wanted to put up hydroxychloroquine up on a pedestal and say, listen, if we can knock down hydroxychloroquine, there will be no treatment for COVID-19, and we can promote some other agenda. Or if we can knock down ivermectin. And Dr. Chetty from South Africa and Dr. Barrentos from South America, given the politicization of both drugs, because ivermectin in the next wave became the next target of politicization, if you will, if it's politics. But I have to tell you, it's so worldwide. I hate that word politicization. I think it's some other process. But the point is, they demonstrated that the syndrome as an outpatient can be treated without those drugs. They use a different combination of drugs in the sequence. The Chetty method is called the time method, where you, in a sense you let the viral you make the virus make its run on replication, and then pick it up with montelukast, cyproheptadine, inhaled steroids, oral steroids, and then anticoagulants. They treat the back end of the syndrome.